What we've done with this is say, this is, we would like to have this, and if you're so kind, would you please consider it?
After last-minute negotiations in the House, the gas line bill heads to the Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new options for mental health care for Alaska youth.
Those services that will be provided at the center have never been available in Fairbanks. They've never been available north of the Brooks Range.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
The gas line is on its way to the Senate last night, and again today, the House gave approval for the Palin administration to issue a license with TransCanada to begin work on developing the project, taking North Slope natural gas to North American markets. But the measure picked up some legislative baggage going out the door. APRN's Dave Donaldson explains.
No member had a change of opinion since casting the original 24-16 vote on the bill. All the amendments that were brought up were rejected during the original debate and did not come up. But the House did add, with no opposition, what's called a letter of intent after taking its final vote. In it, members showed their support for expediting the development of a gas line to fill the state's own needs, urging the administration to focus more on an in-state line. Anchorage Democrat Harry Crawford was one of the sponsors.
We want in-state gas, and we don't want anything to try to hold that up.
The letter was initially distributed to members as they arrived on the House floor for an early session. But that original version, according to supporters of the gas line license, would have turned upside down the entire TransCanada project by declaring that any in-state gas line or any liquefied natural gas project would void any statutory commitments included under the law. Members immediately took a recess where supporters and opponents of the license, along with TransCanada and the administration and lawyers from several different angles, negotiated in an extended flurry of action, sometimes swapping new bargaining points within minutes as they argued openly in the hallway and in second floor offices. The goal was to balance a desire for Alaska gas without turning down the main offer before them. The result was similar to an amendment that had failed in committee and on the floor. And Majority Leader Ralph Samuels, who distributed the original letter, said he would have preferred to see the amendment.
In the giant scheme of things, the administration could say, gee, thanks, but we're going to follow the statute. And with every letter of intent, it might make you feel better. It's not going to do a whole heck of a lot.
A letter of intent does not have the force of law. And as one member described it, it's like writing a letter to the editor. It tells the administration how it would like something done, but it only carries weight in the courts if an issue is ever litigated. Anchorage Republican Bob Roses said passing the amendment would have been a better way of making the point.
What we've done with this is say, this is, we would like to have this, and if you're so kind, would you please consider it? And quite frankly, I don't think it does much of anything except create some political cover for those that decided to not vote for the amendment.
However, Les Guerra of Anchorage argued it doesn't carry the risk of legislation either.
The amendment yesterday would have killed the big gas line, Mr. Speaker. That's why I didn't vote for it, because I said when we started this 2 years ago that I was going to vote with Republicans, Democrats, whoever, to get this done, and that I wasn't going to play politics with the biggest project on the state's horizon. And I feel comfortable with what I've done on this all along.
TransCanada's Vice President for Alaska, Tony Palmer, said he would have preferred the letter not to be included with the bill, but his company will work with it. The bill has already been sent to the Senate, where members have until August 2nd to accept it. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A new youth mental health facility opens next month in Fairbanks. The Boys and Girls Home of Alaska will provide residential treatment previously only available in-state on a limited basis in Anchorage. The 120-bed facility is the product of a partnership between Iowa-based Boys and Girls Home and Family Centered Services of Fairbanks. Family Centered Services Director John Regitano says the new facility will allow kids previously sent to the Lower 48 for treatment to remain in Alaska.
Those services that will be provided at the center have never been available in Fairbanks. They've never been available north of the Brooks Range. And because there's so few beds in Anchorage, very few of them have been able to receive those services even in Alaska. Our primary goal is to not have children leave Alaska anymore from the northern or interior region. That's a key.
Regitano says as many as 300 Alaska kids currently seek treatment in the lower 48 every year. Regitano says between family-centered services and the new Boys and Girls Home, a continuum of youth mental health care will be available in Fairbanks.
We can provide any level they need. We will have outpatient services if it's just some behavioral issues. They can be provided in the home. They can be provided in the community. They can be provided in the school. But then on the other end of the spectrum, we'll have services for children with the most serious mental health issues, children that would be a harm to themselves and others and actually need a locked facility for some time. And there'll be 8 beds on that end of the spectrum.
Regitano says kids will be able to move between intensive residential care, therapeutic foster homes, and outpatient care, transitions which have been slowed by interstate logistics in the past. Boys and Girls Home President and CEO Bob Sheehan says Fairbanks' unique blend of care is expected to shorten treatment.
We believe that kids will linger out of state longer than they would here. And because we're working so closely with family-centered services and we have the whole continuum of services being able to be used now, and we really are working in partnership with each other, we'll be able to move those kids much faster than other places would, because if we move too fast and a kid has an episode, we can move them back for a few days. And then so we have that kind of flexibility that we're not seeing anywhere else.
Keeping kids near home and family will also eliminate disconnect often experienced by youth who relocate to the lower 48 for treatment that can last for up to 2 years in the most serious cases. Regitano says a highly trained staff of 120 people, including psychiatrists, therapists, and nurses, will operate the new Boys and Girls Home. The $28 million campus-like facility includes classrooms, a gym, and cafeteria. Yearly operational costs, estimated at $10 to $11 million, will largely be covered by Medicaid funds, money that in the past has gone to outside treatment centers. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, addressing the high rate of crime in Native communities.
When you've got violent crime rate out in Indian country, it's nearly twice the national average. It's not acceptable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, financial pioneers in Alaska nearly a century ago, bringing Alaskans to the next stage. WellsFargo.com, the next stage. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Legislation introduced today seeks to address the problem of high crime rates in Native communities and reservations across the country. The Tribal Law and Order Act of 2008 was introduced by Senate Indian Affairs Committee Chair Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. It's in response to a call by tribal leaders for help with the disproportionate rates of rape and sexual assault perpetrated against Native women, as well as clarifying and strengthening law enforcement presence in Native communities. Amnesty International released a report last year highlighting the staggering rates of sexual assault and rape of Native women, 2.5 times higher than white women. Senator Lisa Murkowski was a co-sponsor of the legislation. She says the law would aid Native communities with increased tribal court and youth program grants and substance abuse funding.
We anticipate working with the state, working with the Alaska Federation of Natives to see if we can't bring additional federal resources through this bill to improve public safety there in rural Alaska.
Murkowski says the Amnesty International report compiled statistics that have become too common in Native communities.
Just that in-your-face reminder that the trust responsibility that we have in this country, we have simply failed in so many areas when it comes to public safety and law enforcement. And so it's kind of that the focus on what's happening with domestic violence and sexual assault that pushed this off.
Murkowski says strengthening tribal jurisdiction across Indian country must happen quickly to address chronically high levels of crime.
when you've got violent crime rate out in Indian country that's nearly twice the national average, and on some reservations, more than 20 times the national average, you know that it's time that we reassess what goes on within our systems. It's not acceptable.
It would also enhance the sentencing authority of tribal courts and boost resources for investigating and prosecuting crimes of sexual violence. The legislation also requires the Department of Justice to file reports to tribal justice officials that provide details about the cases the federal government declines to prosecute. Murkowski says even though the Senate is now on a short schedule, given the bill's bipartisan support, she is hopeful the legislation will pass quickly. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt is visiting parts of Alaska this week. As part of his three-day trip, Leavitt flew to the YK Delta today. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
Leavitt and his entourage toured the McCann Treatment Center in Bethel, which is an inpatient treatment facility for youth with inhalant addiction. Leavitt then went by boat 15 miles up the Kuskokwim River to the village of Kweethluk. There, he saw the local health clinic and the sewer lagoon where residents dumped their honey buckets. He stopped at the Bethel Boat Harbor on the way back to answer a few questions by the local media.
What I gained most from this is a chance to see it all at one time. And when I say it all, I mean I saw health care, I saw the need for sanitation systems, I had a chance to understand telemedicine in a better way, and it will improve my decision-making.
Leavitt spent about 45 minutes in Kweethluk speaking with community leaders. He says he's been in a lot of places in rural America, but this place was unique, particularly the people he met.
I think that might be the most impressive thing I've seen, is the number of people who devote their life to trying to make the lives of people in remote Alaska better.
Leavitt says there are still things that need improving.
I saw the need for sewer and water systems today. That was evident to me. I had a chance to see a substance abuse home that was, I think, unique on Huffing. I hadn't seen that before. Meeting some of the people who were there, young men that were there, was a poignant thing to me.
On Thursday, Leavitt will present Acting Health Commissioner Bill Hogan the National President's Challenge Award for Alaska having one of the highest number of people exercising for the challenge. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Increased wood and coal burning for heating in the Fairbanks area has local officials concerned about air pollution. Borough air quality specialist Jim Connor says tiny airborne particles released by combustion have been recognized as a serious health concern.
Particulates are so small. They're the PM2.5 is really something that's 2.5 microns and smaller in aerodynamic diameter. These particles are small enough to get past the defenses in your lungs. And there are long-term effects for short-term exposure.
Asthma is one of the big risks and one of the reasons the Environmental Protection Agency drastically tightened the standard for fine particulates in 2006. Fairbanks has violated EPA particulate standards during recent winters. The issue arises just as Fairbanks officials wind down a controversial vehicle emissions program because of carbon monoxide. Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller says the science on particulates is more certain.
The CO issue of years ago, there was a lot of controversy around the science around the standard for CO and how it was developed and implemented. But I think the science for PM2.5, it's pretty sound. When you consider we have a lot more wood burning, coal burning, these outdoor wood boilers that are being installed in residential areas, individuals really should be concerned about health effects.
The borough spent last winter monitoring for particulates with a mobile test van to try to track down their origin. Connor says peak readings were logged in residential areas where people have switched from oil to wood or coal for heat. Now more people are turning to wood.
And this summer, you know, we're seeing hundreds of these units being sold and installed. And whereas they might have been a local problem before, they may become an area-wide problem if there's enough of them.
Remedies could include regulations and incentives when it comes to wood and coal burning, including consumer rebates for replacement of old wood stoves. Another factor contributing to fine particulate output is the burning of under-seasoned wood. The borough's miller says that's anticipated to be a major problem this winter. Borough officials recently met with local wood stove and boiler retailers to encourage them to pass on information about clean burning practices to customers. The municipality of Anchorage's official war on obesity is not going well. Those trying to coordinate the effort for slimmer citizens say they need more resources, including a municipal coordinator. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
A little over 2 years ago, the Mayor's Task Force on Obesity and Health presented its 10-year plan of action to the Anchorage Assembly. At the most recent assembly meeting, the chair of the Municipal Health and Human Services Commission, Brian Saylor, presented a doleful summary of the group's achievements.
I'm sorry to report that our progress is meager.
Saylor says the appraisal is deeply troubling because obesity is nothing less than an epidemic, one especially harmful to children.
The National Institutes of Health projects that the children today will be the first generation in U.S. history to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. One of the principal ingredients in this massive change in health status is obesity.
Anchorage and Alaska are firmly part of the national obesity pattern. Saylor said figures from the NIH, the Centers for Disease Control, the State Division of Epidemiology, and the Anchorage School District all indicate about one-third of the state's elementary school students are overweight or are in danger of being overweight. In some cases, the adult situation in Alaska is even worse, with more than half of the adults overweight.
This costs about $29 million a year in additional health-related expenses statewide, so it's a substantial public health problem as well as a fiscal problem.
Saylor could point to some success, most notably within the Anchorage School District. The district has removed junk food from vending machines and increased physical education time. Ironically, reports discussed at school board meetings show the snack changes and even the lunch meal improvements have not been without cost. Vending machine profits that help support school activities have dropped, while healthier foods served in cafeteria meals are one reason given for the district's food program no longer being financially self-sufficient. Healthier food costs more money, said School Superintendent Carol Como at a June board meeting. Saylor described the pedestrian facilities plan passed by the Anchorage Assembly in 2007 as a notable achievement. Along with diet and exercise, he said, community planning plays an important role in the obesity battle, the idea being a walking citizenry is a leaner citizenry. But overall, Saylor said, the task force research showed, quote, significant need and little progress.
We believe on the commission that it is largely due to our lack of resources, assigned responsible parties within the plan, and any central staff to coordinate the community-wide activities that are going to help to mitigate this severe epidemic.
A proposed coordinator position did not survive this year's budget process. Two Anchorage Assembly members praised the task force plans, even if largely unrealized. But member Bill Starr asked Saylor just what should be the city's role in battling obesity.
I had a question about your goal to suggest accessibility to health food in restaurants and grocery stores. Why is the municipality engaged with that task? Is that our issue to encourage healthy eating in public places?
Yeah.
As a basic public health intervention, I think it is. Just as New York City, as a unit of local government, elected to ban trans fats from the restaurant menus, the municipality could encourage restaurants to have healthier choices available.
Starr asked, does that responsibility mean hanging city-sponsored danger signs by sidewalk hot dog stands? Saylor responded.
We don't need to do it. We don't need to be cops, you know, food cops. We certainly need to be aware of it and encourage people to have the opportunity to make healthier choices.
The Mayor's Task Force on Obesity and Health 10-year plan report requested by the Assembly was informational only. it did not require any action. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com.
National Transportation Safety Board investigators say a long list of errors by captain and crew led to the grounding of the Empress of the North in Icy Strait last year. Icy Strait is a main shipping route west of Juneau. From member station KTOO, John Ryan reports.
Top of the list, the captain's decision to put unqualified people in control of the ship during a midnight watch as the ship prepared to make the turn from Lynn Canal into Icy Strait. The NTSB would not release the name of the paddle wheel cruise ship captain. About 24 hours before the May 2007 accident, the ship's third mate got sick and he was quarantined to his room. The captain then assigned a junior third mate to take control on that night's watch. The junior third mate had joined the Empress a week before and was neither licensed to pilot the ship through Alaskan waters nor familiar with the ship's handling. Three different navigational charts on the bridge suggested three different courses around Point Coverdon. The captain did not leave the explicit instructions known as night orders for the inexperienced crew on the bridge. The rookie third mate and the helmsman tried to sharply turn the ship inside Rocky Island, but they started to turn too late and failed to override the autopilot's controls against sharp turns. As a result, they plowed sideways into the well-marked island. At a hearing on the accident, NTSB board member Kitty Higgins asked investigators the wisdom of not issuing night orders.
If there was ever a case in which night orders should have been prepared and been available to these people to read, it seems to me it would have been on that particular evening. Would you agree?
Yes, staff would definitely concur with that.
NTSB investigators say they are unaware of any other accident where the mate was on his first watch, let alone in waters where an expert pilot is legally required. Investigator Barry Strouch said the errors of the captain were so outside the norm that it would be difficult to anticipate how to prevent them. The NTSB approved 16 findings pointing to problems on the ship, in Majestic America Line's headquarters, and problems with emergency equipment contractors and the U.S. Coast Guard. Here's NTSB Chair Mark Rosenkerr.
Number 11. Junior third mate was not qualified to stand watch on the accident route because he did not hold a federal pilot's license or meet the requirements of a self-certified pilot. Number 12. The Coast Guard failed to identify critical deficiencies in the Empress of the North documentation during the vessel's 2007 annual inspection.
Majestic America Line spokeswoman Amy McIver declined to comment until the company could review the full safety board report. Poorly maintained life raft launchers and emergency slides failed after the accident, but the NTSB praised the human response to the accident.
The response to the emergency by all those involved, the vessel's crew, the master, the Good Samaritan vessels, the Coast Guard, and the city of Juneau was timely and effective.
Staff of the NTSB say Majestic America has substantially improved its safety practices since the accident. The Empress of the North is currently on a 7-day cruise through Southeast Alaska. Majestic America Lines had to cancel the Empress's remaining cruises after the first week of August because of poor advance sales. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
More people are riding state ferries in Southeast this summer. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The fast ferry Fairweather winds its way through narrow channels on its way from Juneau to Sitka. Matthew Turner shares a windowside table with family and friends, snacking and playing cards. The Sitka resident is one of the people taking advantage of the Fairweather's increased sailings on the route this summer.
Well, it's been fantastic. I mean, clearly we're using it, and it's nice to have a nice predictable schedule to kind of know when we can and can come and get back and invite people over to visit us as well.
He's not alone. Ferry use is up almost 10% so far this summer in Southeast. Sailings from Sitka have attracted 27% more passengers and vehicles, and other communities have seen ridership increases ranging from 5 to 55%. Ferry System Chief Jim Beadle says riders have responded quickly to changes announced earlier this year.
The surprising thing is, we're just weeks into this
schedule change, you know, a couple months now, and that we have had such a response so quickly. Normally, it takes a while. It takes 2-3 years for people to figure out the patterns and figure out how they're going to use it.
The summer schedule sent the Juneau-based Fairweather to Sitka 5 days a week and to Petersburg twice. That's an increase for Sitka and a new connection for Petersburg. It also took the mainliner Malaspina off the Bellingham route and put it in Lynn Canal, sailing between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. The schedule also increased sailings from Prince Rupert, and marketing efforts attempted to shift some of the Bellingham traffic north. Beadle says additional Rupert traffic has helped Petersburg and Wrangell, which saw 30-40% increases in ridership.
A lot of your Bellingham traffic, they get on in Bellingham and they go straight through to the roadhead, either Haines or Skagway, and they don't really stop in southeast. Your Prince Rupert traffic's a little bit different. You know, they're used to stopping and camping and driving the road and spending nights places, and they tend to get off and spend more time in southeast.
The Bellingham route has only one ship this summer, and ridership is down 30%. Ferry officials are pleased with the response to Sitka's increased fast ferry sailings. Petersburg's new runs are attracting fewer riders, but managers aren't ready to make any judgment calls yet. Dave Berg of Petersburg's Viking Travel says the Fairweather runs are popular, but he says a lot of people don't know about them.
I think it's still penetrating. We talk to people all the time that are unaware of their options of taking the fast ferry, and so I think more marketing can be done to encourage people to use the options that are out there. It is early in this, although we did have a trial with the fast ferry during the wintertime a couple of years back.
That brief trial run attracted few riders. Marine Highway critics said it didn't give residents enough time to get used to the idea. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle says the current summer schedule will stay largely the same for as long as possible. That allows riders to make reservations earlier and residents to develop travel patterns.
You know, it takes 2-3 years for people to figure out how to use the system, and if you just leave it alone and be consistent, then people will figure out how to make the system work for them.
Back on board the Fairweather, Sitkan Kayla Betcher says she likes the speed and convenience, but she admits she misses aspects of the larger, slower ships.
We were describing to our visitors here about the older ferries and just the different kinds of rooms that they have, you know, the observational deck and the movie room and the, you know, just kind of sit and hang out place and the cafeteria and having, you know, real food being made right before your eyes. And all those things are really fun aspects of the older ferries.
Ridership figures are for May 11th through July 13th and are based on departures. Officials say exact comparisons are difficult given route and schedule changes and outside factors such as the general state of the economy. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson also reported from Juneau. Dave Waldron and Gooseberry Peter are our audio engineers. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.